Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 31st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing Government Transparency and the Freedom of Information Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and as always, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're pleased to have with us today two experts on our call. Mr. Christopher Horner is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in its Center for Energy and Environment. He is also the author of the book we'll be discussing today, The Liberal War on Transparency, Confessions of a Freedom of Information Criminal. And that book, the link to that book was provided to you in the notice of today's call. It's also available on the Federalist Society's website and should be easy enough for you to find. We're also joined on our call today by Mr. Clark Neely, a return guest. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. Our format today is a little bit different than we sometimes do. We'll have some opening thoughts by Mr. Horner, about 8 to 10 minutes, and then some back and forth between him and Mr. Neely, maybe even including some questions. But ultimately, we'll turn to you, the audience, for your questions. Mr. Clark Neely, you're going to get us started, so go right ahead.
Well, thanks very much, Dean, and thanks to Chris Horner for a fascinating read. I really enjoyed reading the book, Liberal War on Transparency, and I thought I'd start by noting that as a constitutional litigator for the Institute for Justice, I'm becoming more and more aware with every year that goes by of the fact that when public officials do their jobs, they're often not even really making any sort of a semblance of an effort to advance public policy. They're often acting either in their own interests or at the behest of politically powerful entities. And I'm aware as a constitutional litigator how pervasive that issue is. What I wasn't fully aware of until I read Chris's book was how brazenly aggressive these people can be in refusing to disclose to the taxpayers, to the people who pay their salaries, the truth about what they're doing day in and day out, the truth about the communications that they're having with their colleagues and with others. And so for me as a constitutional litigator, the book was really an eye-opener that the kind of misbehavior I see when I bring the sort of cases that IJ litigates is replicated in the very setting in which citizens are supposed to have access to information about what our public servants are doing. And so it was a very troubling book, but a very interesting book, and there's a lot of practical information in the book for people who want to shine more light on government. So, Chris, with that, I'm really pleased to be here with you today, and thank you for such an excellent book.
Thank you very much, and for Dean for doing this. I do think this is very important. It is FOIA or transparency, whether it's at the federal level or state, where the same principles apply, is one of the very few things that the limited government crowd has right now, because you have to educate the public, who will then educate the lawmakers on what their priorities are. And we have found that, a lot can get lost in the background noise of all of what's going on in policymaking, but there is an interest in emails somehow. Maybe it's a prurient interest, but somehow it indicates and certainly often represents the candor between government employees that you don't get from them when you're dealing with them directly. So I wrote the book for a few reasons, the overriding one being what was obviously a dramatic increase in the reluctance of bureaucracies to provide the legally required, if typically elusive, transparency under the most transparent administration ever. I had also turned up a lot of flagrant misbehavior in fighting this reluctance, which I'll provide some examples. And I'd seen a remarkable disparity in treatment depending on who you were. Identity really matters when you're seeking public records, apparently. In fact, the Washington Post's May Day editorial from, I think, 2012 was about me personally, involving a Virginia Freedom of Information Act request of ours, which the state Supreme Court has now agreed to hear on January 4th, by the way, involving these ClimateGate records. And they were saying, look at the title of one of his books, and the implication was somebody like this, why he shouldn't be allowed access to public records. We're not talking about a researcher here, one of us, an academic. We're talking about somebody who's a critic of what these people are trying to do. And as Christian Adams, who's, I believe, a Federalist Society member, first pointed out, this most transparent administration in history promise in practice essentially meant they were going to bend over backward to get Bush records out to friends, sometimes overnight. But if you were viewed as unfriendly, you would be ignored and or have obstacles thrown in your way when you push the issue. I also found the pledge seemed to have been made about most transparent administration ever with the understanding that they had ways to avoid creating records in the first place, which is a nice counterpart to resisting production of whatever they did create. I won't go too much into what was an early sign of where they were going to go, but you may remember President Obama insisted that his BlackBerry be exempt from the Presidential Records Act. And his nominal reason for saying I'm different was that he didn't think his emails with his daughters should go down as something the public's going to read. Well, that's not – they weren't going to be, and the executive has an obligation to separate the personal from the official. There are numerous ways those emails would not have ended up in the public domain. This was really just a straw argument to get his BlackBerry out from what the law says, which is his correspondence should go down for the record and ultimately be revealed. With exceptions. Well, soon after that, we saw stories of White House aides using private email accounts to arrange off-campus meetings with lobbyists. So there's several things, obviously, in that equation. They were avoiding creation of a record of the meeting occurring, being arranged. They were avoiding creation of a record in the visitor logs of the meeting occurring. And, of course, it was using private email accounts for lobbyists, both of which, of course, were not consistent with the administration's rhetoric, which, by the way, persisted past the campaign. Into the second day of the administration, there were more pronouncements, executive, a memo to the heads of agencies, two attorney general memos saying we're going to stop this abuse of the B-5 deliberative process exemption. We're going to err on the side of disclosure and so on. That proved to be nothing but lip service. That is clearly not what's going on. So we saw some stories, they were one-offs, about Caribou Coffee across in the White House, in the New York Times and in Mother Jones, about this practice. I've since found that this use of private email accounts to conduct official business is systematic, it's systemic, it's very deliberate. One now fairly well-known example is 14 separate such accounts were used to administer the program made infamous by Solyndra. I found at least four regional administrators of EPA using private email accounts. One of them denied it, filed an affidavit in our lawsuit seeking his private account email, work-related private account email, filed a second affidavit saying, I stand by my first affidavit. I rarely did this. And then ultimately when we said, look, Your Honor, he's searching the cloud, not his machine. Instead of the most conflicted party searching, we'd like to search and the private machine or account. He quit, got a lawyer, and has been turning over records to congressional investigators. He's the first of four whose work-related emails we are seeking. It's a very common practice, but regardless of the intention, conducting public business on private email accounts doesn't make the business any more private or any less public. There are problems with forcing production, of course, particularly when they quit, but we encounter those ad hoc and regularly. But anyway, we seem to have broken the barrier here where it's recognized. It's in most agency policies, and yet we still encounter problems. Last night, we finally received an order from the D.C. federal court in a case that had been fully briefed for 24 months, indicating that they were not going to search a private email account, even though it was quite obvious work-related emails were on it. So we need to continue developing the law in this. The Richard Windsor case, which you may know of, was a false identity email account created for former Administrator Lisa Jackson. She and her defenders have said everybody did it. There is no evidence anyone has ever done it. All secondary email accounts always identified the sender. You have to identify the parties in an email to be a record, and you have to create a record of your correspondence. So if you're going to create email, you have to identify the parties. There's no evidence any administrator showed anybody but their name or Administrator Whitman in the from field before. They never had a false identity. And one practice we're seeing in that case right now, EPA is still refusing to produce in any part, that is, they're withholding in full, 1,400 Richard Windsor emails. And they have to turn over factual information. And emails obviously contain factual information. from, to, date, typically subject. You can, if it's not segregable, then they can redact entire portions, but of course, that's obviously segregable. So you know there's something strange when an agency is withholding, Treasury is withholding hundreds of emails in full about their carbon tax discussions. That's a practice that we're challenging now, and so far have not received a fulsome legal rebuttal from an agency, but they are fighting it at every turn because for some reason to, from, date, and subject are too frightening to them, the prospect of letting the public see that. As Clark noted, some of these public servants are often serving as adjuncts for pressure groups. I just received some more emails where green groups are asking EPA to lean on the Centers for Disease Control, and then they get the sufficient response and they call off the dogs. I mean, the revolving door manifests itself in that way sometimes. And you do see that a lot, for example, among these EPA regional administrators we found using private email accounts. There are 10 of them. So far, I found 4 using private email accounts. Of these 10 regional administrators, 6 came from the environmental pressure group world. So it's something that you can imagine, as we found, they continue their correspondence with their universe of colleagues on their private email account about work-related topics, and so we're continuing to pursue those. I've got a lot more to say. What I'll just do is point out a couple of gems we've found. Richard Windsor was awarded Scholar of Ethics Awards 3 years running, a person who did not exist, just telling you how seriously they were taking their oversight. I found an email from EPA's Office of General Counsel discussing a protocol. This is now in a related to a case that 12 state attorneys general have with the agency now. They were seeking information about sue and settle, this practice that is just what it sounds like. And I found an email from OGC to Region 6 saying about such requests, and the context made it clear they were talking about problematic or unwanted requests under FOIA. They said, well, I think we have a protocol for such requests, and that is tell them that it's going to cost more than whatever it is they agreed to pay, and that it's overly broad. And this is their protocol for dealing with unwanted requests. And in fact, in practice, we're seeing this quite often. We found this at FERC. We found practices at NASA. We found practices at EPA, Department of Energy. It really is government-wide. I could go on forever. It may seem as if I have, so I will just, I suppose, leave that basic information dump out there and then have some back and forth.
Terrific. Clark Neely, you want to resume the discussion? Clark, you might have muted your phone. I'm not sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dean. I appreciate that. One of my questions, I think probably a lot of listeners would love to get the answer to this question, too, is in your book, you quote a lawyer who worked on FOIA cases for a long time as saying that the Obama administration is the worst. She described herself as stunned at the fact that this administration was so bad on FOIA. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, it was the transparency, the most transparent administration ever accepted a transparency award and closed it to the press. I mean, that's how bad it is. And all of their allies who were believing the rhetoric and maybe not fully thinking it through, and again, I suggest that the administration did, they were going to turn over the other guy's records. Their records were going to be very elusive because they had no intention of being transparent about their own. I think the evidence has shown that. But also they've engaged in many, many practices, and I detail them, privately owned computer servers, you name it, false identity email accounts, private email accounts, moving government over to Gmail, text messaging we found they're using like teenagers and destroying them in the thousands and putting in systems that allow them to do that without retaining the metadata so you know who they were texting with. I mean, really, organized efforts to make sure you don't know, as the Supremes have said, what your government is up to. Well, this seems fairly well thought through in advance. The cheerleaders of the administration, apparently believing this rhetoric, claimed to be stunned when they found almost immediately that the administration, in fact, was not at all intending to be transparent. In fact, they were so against transparency that they were ratcheting up the number of prosecutions of whistleblowers. One administration official I quoted from a news report told a journalist, we don't have to ask you who your sources are. We know who you're talking to. all sorts of cryptic remarks indicating a very heavy-handed approach to ensure that they were not, in fact, victims of transparency. And numerous of their allies were expressing shock to publications like Politico that this is not at all what was promised, not at all.
Another thing that was very surprising to me and troubling in reading the book, and this pops up throughout the book, is that now that the shoe is kind of on the other foot and that liberals have really taken firm hold in various institutions and settings, this idea seems to be emerging, at least in some of these conflicts, that the motivation of the person seeking the information under FOIA or the identity of the person seeking the information is somehow relevant to whether the information should be produced. And that's happened to you in some of your cases, and so can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, one of the most glaring admissions of this was, I suppose, my first foray into this realm of any profile involved the University of Virginia emails, which we sought after Greenpeace had sought emails of two what you call climate skeptics in UVA's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. That may not be correct. And I thought that was a great idea. So I asked for the emails of two others at UVA, or one, the infamous man behind the hockey stick, or lead author, Michael Mann. And suddenly, I mean, the heavens came down. The Post had their editorial called, "I Was Harassing Climate Scientists." That was the title of the editorial. Greenpeace told the local newspaper here in Charlottesville, which is where I am, they love that, that although I was aping their behavior in every way except for the parties whose emails were subject to our request, the most sincere form of flattery, by imitating them, they said our requests are not at all alike or have nothing in common, they said. And they told the reporter for Seaville Weekly the reason was our objectives are different. Now, I've scoured the law, and that's actually found nowhere in there. This is not as the media and the people who were working this corner for so long viewed this law for us, by us. In no way is it. It's motive neutral. It's identity neutral. We even had at trial in the UVA case, Mann's lawyer stood up and gave a 40 or so minute discourse using everything but the word Bilderberg in his conspiracy theory about how we were such bad people and therefore apparently should not be given access to public records. And the judge looked down after a while and said, "Let me ask you something. I guess this is required now, and so, and you have to say what bad people others are, but I need to know, does this influence how I interpret the law? Does the law change depending on whether or not these are good people?" And the lawyer said, "Well, no, actually, I think the law is very clear on that." And the judge stopped him and said, "Then why are you arguing this to me?" And there was a similar one where it was about motivations. And the judge said, "Look, that is not found in the law." And it isn't. But it is raised as a rhetorical defense by newspapers, by academics, universities, anyone who doesn't like this idea of others using laws that they were sure were drafted by them for them. But again, as our court made very clear, it has nothing to do with it, and yet it's often their lead argument.
What about the claims of academics and others who work in that kind of a setting that academic freedom requires them to be able to keep their communications private, to not have to share emails where they're working through theories and developing ideas with colleagues? That's a theme that is in your book as well, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Right. Academic freedom was raised quite a lot in the UVA case. We recently filed against University of Arizona as well. And I think they're being more cooperative so far. The early stages indicate they will be. But there was quite an effort mobilized by pressure groups related to professors and academic associations to say that academic freedom means that these pieces of paper that the professors signed, the conditions of their employment with the taxpayer, need to be changed retroactively. Because they suddenly decide that while they did literally sign up for it, they no longer agree with these pieces of paper saying your correspondence, if you choose to use this taxpayer-provided system provided for your work, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. These are public records. There are exceptions. The universities are written into the law often expressly. The Virginia universities are expressly written into the law, and at trial, the court wrote them out, but not on academic freedom grounds. He said proprietary information is an exemption, and I will define that as being anything the university owns. Well, obviously, that writes the school out of a law they were expressly written into, and I think that's why the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case here in Virginia. But academic freedom did not get anywhere. That right, if it exists, the Fourth Circuit has said, it belongs to the university, not to the individual professor. Now, we say, if you're talking about research, pre-publication, it is quite clear that as you are running down these alleys, information should be not have to be released. I mean, there is a period of time. But when, for example, we're dealing with a paper that is published 10 years ago, blind alleys that they've abandoned that may be of benefit to others who would like to pick them up, and there are examples throughout history of where that's happened successfully, or in this case, where you've got information that is at the center of what Christopher Booker and the Telegraph called the worst scientific scandal of our generation. No, emails talking about the worst scientific scandal of our generation, among numerous taxpayer-funded academics on numerous taxpayer-funded systems, subject to the UK FOIA law, federal FOIA law, various state FOI laws, this is not about academic freedom. These are blind alleys. This is a scientific scandal. This is a paper published 10 years ago. There's not been a reasonable argument for why that kind of discussion needs to be protected as academic freedom.
Can we go back to the Obama administration for a moment? I found myself wondering as I read the book whether the extraordinary lack of transparency and the resistance to providing information that the law requires them to provide was more the natural outgrowth of an essentially arrogant and statist mindset, or is this deeper? Is it more systemic? Is it an actual committed plan within the administration to resist the production of publicly or what should be publicly available information?
I don't think a memo – this wouldn't be the team to write such a memo. They would send it by text and destroy it. But I don't think a memo ever went out, we shall use private email accounts. But it's pretty clear. It's government-wide that they are moving government over to Gmail with its administration. I'm sure they're doing it elsewhere. We don't have examples of it happening before, but I do have an example in that NASA case. We just got an order on last night, finally. That certain practices were underway by activists within government for years. In that case, they brought a taxpayer-funded desktop computer into the office, purchased with an NSF grant, but not owned by the taxpayer, would access their NASA emails on this computer through a system they designed whereby it destroyed NASA's copy on its spool, retained the NASA email only on this publicly purchased, privately owned computer, and he wouldn't let investigators access it to respond to FOIA because it turned out the guy was running an activist website from the NASA office during business hours. That preceded this administration. But it's certainly at home in this administration that really doubled down on those things with having universities provide them computer servers to circumvent FOIA and so on for them to sort of safe houses to duck in and out. There's clearly an understanding. I don't know if the president saying my BlackBerry shouldn't be covered by the law was a dog whistle to everyone else to move things over to Gmail, but it was when the first stories came out of White House aides arranging meetings to get around the visitor's logs, to get around their White House email account, it was pretty clear that there was an understanding. I'm sure it was just tacit, but there is plainly an understanding. And the obstructionism, despite all of the memos, despite all of the rhetoric, I'm finding if you go through these productions we receive, you will find that entire offices are just lying. For example, if you go to Treasury and ask two separate offices for email about carbon tax, one office, after you file suit, will turn over emails. The other office, which should have many, says no records. And yet upon scrutiny, the first office's production shows you officials from the other office that says it has nothing are engaged in these conversations, and yet they're just lying to you. That has to go through the lawyers. We've had DOJ submit affidavits saying the reason we're not providing you records is because we've created very elaborate systems to destroy them. We've had DOJ submit statements on behalf of EPA officials saying, well, yeah, she's destroying all of her text messages, but she's sure that all 3,932 were personal, even though that was not permissible, and so on. Nobody seems to care. When you're having DOJ file this, shrug their shoulders and walk away, even though this should trigger a whole series of actions, they're required by law to then bring in the National Archives, say we found a problem, we have to report this and remedy it. There's no interest in that. So it's a way of life, I have to say.
Yeah. That brings me to a point that really resonated with me as a kind of a fellow lawyer and litigator and someone who has seen a lot of this stuff in the trenches. You have a subheading in one of your chapters, and it reads, "How's that self-policing working out? Fox meet hen house." I thought that was great, really a well-turned phrase, and I'd love to hear more about what's behind that when you ask that rhetorical question.
Well, okay, so the academics, for example, were first saying, well, we don't need to be subject to this law we agreed to as a condition of our employment. We cashed the checks, but now we want to change our contract. Because anyway, we're very good self-policing. Academics can police themselves. And I demonstrate how that is. They have no intention of policing themselves. But with the administration, for example, this is not unique to the administration, but there's certainly we found they're abusing it. When a FOIA request comes in, there's not an IT officer who then conducts a keyword search and provides the records. The individual who stands the most embarrassment is asked, these guys sought or seek records. They want to know if you're dealing with your former Green Group employer, if you have any emails, or if you've been using your AOL. And they tend to conduct a search that's very self-serving. For example, we had a career NOAA official who received numerous requests for documents relating to this UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And Steve McIntyre, the Canadian statistician who first uncovered the hockey sticks problems, and others had asked for these IPCC records. And every time she received a request, she said, you know, if I had any such records, I would have been working for the UN at the time. By the way, she never worked for the UN. She was never delegated. She was never seconded. There's a process for this. It involves paperwork. There is no such paperwork. We know this because of an Inspector General report, which all came about because they tried that with me. And I said, wait a second. You're telling me if they exist, they're UN records. There's no such thing as you holding UN records on your computer as part of your job. They're agency records. But she had for several years been saying, if I had any such records, I would have been wearing a UN hat at the time. Well, that showed you the weakness of leaving it to the most conflicted person imaginable to decide whether there's anything that the taxpayer deserves to see. But that's how the law is being implemented. Maybe they say it's a practical matter, but it's not always the most practical response. At the University of Arizona, they left it to the two academics to decide what was potentially responsive and to offer their own exemptions. And so one, at least they provided us almost a Vaughn index, a roadmap, detailing all these emails they said we couldn't have, and they just said, well, these are deliberative process. Arizona doesn't have a deliberative process exemption. They'd been speaking to somebody who said, claim this. Well, that's why you have a public records officer, so these games aren't engaged in. Self-policing doesn't work, and it goes all the way down to the very basics of when the FOIA request goes to an agency, they send it to the party who has the most incentive to not find something that may be there.
Excellent. Thank you. Dean, we got time to ask some questions?
We sure do. Before we turn to the audience for questions, let me make a brief programming announcement. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., we'll have a teleforum conference call, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, looking at the FCC and state authority to regulate telecommunications and opportunities for cooperation in that endeavor. And then next week, we have a teleforum slate that is full, conference calls each day. On Monday, we'll be discussing the Sandifer U.S. Supreme Court case. That's a labor and employment case on donning and doffing equipment and clothes. Tuesday, the Bond case, which I think everybody's probably familiar with, on the extent of authority of Congress under the treaty power and under Article 1, Section 8. And then on Wednesday, town of Greece, another case being argued in the court next week. That's a legislative prayer case. Thursday, another book forum where we'll be talking with author Peter Schweitzer. And then on Friday, yet another Courthouse Steps version of Teleform, this one on the Medtronic case. Today, of course, we're talking with Chris Horner about his book. And we're now ready for your questions. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Chris Horner or even suppose Clark Neely, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And with that, let's go to our first caller. It looks like we have one question and our lines are open. So if you have a question, star and then pound on your telephone.
Hi, this is Hugo Teufel. Curiously, I've got a meeting with a client right now on the very subject that I want to ask about, but and that is the Federal Records Act and records management. We've talked about FOIA here, but I would be interested to hear from both speakers about the application of the Federal Records Act to the use of Google Gmail to conduct federal business.
This is Chris. We have...
And I note that there are criminal penalties associated with violation of the Federal Records Act.
Well, there is one that the 182071, concealment, removal, or mutilation generally, seems to be pretty clear, and that is if it's a record, you don't have, for example, what EPA is doing with senior officials' text messaging is a facial violation of this, and they're going to have to explain why it's not. But what it is you've got Federal Records Act, you've got FOIA. Federal Records Act requires that you create a record of your activities, but it has to be, this is not the term of art, but a meaningful activity. It has to document, and there's a whole litany of what rises to the level of a record. But that actually, that determination is up to the agency. And we found agencies just avoiding making determinations on certain classes of records. So, they, for example, using a private university's server to, as a safe house where they can duck in, have these conversations about the IPCC, and then get out and say, well, anything I downloaded, if I downloaded it, it would have been a record, but I didn't download it, we just dropped in, and so on. FOIA has the broadest definition of any of these laws of a record. And so that's the one that would apply, particularly for these purposes. FRA may say it's not, but if your request is in, well, anything that's been requested, they can't destroy anyway until that's been resolved. But that's the broader definition. And
well, no, I agree with you that agency record is broader than a federal record, but it's very clear that whether it may not be a destruction of a federal record, but arguably it's alienation of a federal record, and it is and certainly it would meet the definition of a federal record under 44 U.S.C. 3301. Functionally, it's a federal record. And yet it's a record that is created and maintained on a system outside of the federal enclave for the purposes of it not being made available, whether under FOIA or a subpoena from a law enforcement agency or a congressional committee of competent jurisdiction.
Yeah, look. We found them doing it broadly, and if the intent is clear enough, then you find a way to obtain a copy. But if you don't, then yes, you make the effort to say they violated it. If there's no copy available, which is beyond right now my tech capacity, if there's no evidence anywhere, no metadata to decide what was going on, then you get into a swearing contest. But the fact is, if you find they've created, for example, we had an official creating an account, firstname.lastname.agencyacronym@gmail.com. He did this at one agency. He did it at a second agency. We suspected he was doing it at a third agency. It turned out he was using me.com for these purposes. Well, those are quite obviously records. And you're talking about sanctions. We haven't gotten there yet, though we did just recently file an action seeking to enjoin this practice and then indicating that, I mean, we're hoping it's an APA violation, a FOIA violation, FRA violation, maybe worse, but if they're doing this to avoid, I'm not sure specifically what the question is, if they're doing this to avoid capture under the law, it's not a useful means of avoiding the law.
Right. No, I'm not so sure that I really posed a question there as much as I wanted to have some discussion on the Federal Records Act, because when we talk about these things and we look at what this agency or this administration in particular has done to avoid both FOIA and the Federal Records Act, many are not familiar with the confines of the Federal Records Act, what it requires, and what the penalties are for violation, willful violation of the Federal Records Act. And so, really, I wanted to hear from one or both of you on that, because I think those who are listening may not be familiar with the Federal Records Act.
My opinion is this is going to be a developing – we're trying to help develop it. This is going to be a developing area of the law, if only because it is so promiscuous, this effort to – you're not avoiding creating a record. You're hoping to avoid detection of the record. And there was a case in the UK that I wrote about where a minister had set up a Gmail account named Mrs. Blurt. He was an education minister. And the information commissioner reviewed this after the gentleman got caught because someone had an exemplar after they denied that this account existed. And he said, look, one commentator said, it appears that having adopted a FOI law modeled after the United States, UK politicians are now adopting behavior being used in the United States, which is to move government over to private email. And as the information commissioner's office said, you can do that, but it doesn't. That has no bearing on whether or not it's a record. It may have bearing on your ability to access the record because they have sole control over it, which is the whole requirement. Every agency says you shall not do this. If your liner hits an iceberg and you're stuck with only your personal BlackBerry and you have to send a work-related email, copy your office. In fact, they call it gold standard with a paper copy, but you have to copy your office. The point is, if they don't, then they've had sole control over this with the one saving grace, which is what tripped up Mrs. Blurt, which is on correspondence, there's always another party to the correspondence. In fact, for example, we found that Jim Messina was using his AOL account to strike the deal on Obamacare, not his White House account, even though he was not covered by FOIA. That was to avoid that going down in the record, it seems. Well, the reason they were able to discover this is because while the White House wasn't subject to congressional investigators getting heavy with them, the parties on the other end of the correspondence weren't so sanguine about the prospect of a subpoena. And so they vomited up all sorts of emails showing these practices. The good news is there's always someone else at the other end of the correspondence, because while it doesn't avoid creating a record, they can avoid detection. That seems to be the goal.
Right. And so you know, the answer is, I think, if you don't want to create a record, then don't create a record. Get on the phone.
Right.
Make a phone call.
Mm-hmm. Once again, thank you. We're talking to Mr. Clark Neely and Mr. Chris Horner. We have two questions pending right now. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone.
Hi, this is Teresa Goody, and I was calling to see if you could answer some practical questions about when you're filing a FOIA request, because there seems to be thresholds in hours and maybe cost of when it gets kicked into FIFO, and then you can end up waiting years before you get your documents. Can you explain what that threshold is so that we can try and keep our FOIA requests under that?
I'm not actually familiar with that. We come in as a 501c3 on all of mine, and we argue extensively each time for fee waivers. They deny them at the initial determination stage with us now almost uniformly. That's led to an inspector general inquiry. While the others can send a request on a cocktail napkin and get it FedEx to them the next day, we aren't treated that way. But we do warrant fee waivers, and we do, with now just one exception this week, we always get them, the denials, overturned on appeal. So I've never encountered this.
Very good. We've got three questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, this is Bill Severson. I wonder if you could comment on the sort of the attitude you find in the courts in these cases among judges. Kind of, what's the variation? Is there a variation depending upon, you know, who the judge was appointed by, that sort of thing?
If there's a basic attitude, despite the obvious bias written into the law and the initial precedent that, look, this is all about disclosure, and the president's non-binding memos and rhetoric and AG memos, the biases tend to be toward giving the agency the same benefit of the doubt they get with deference. It's sometimes too much, but what I see is it can be different depending upon the judge's experience. I'm optimistic with recent trends. There were several very favorable opinions in the last year, as well as this Crew decision in the D.C. Circuit in April, which said it's taken us, 47 years to clear our judicial throat, but it turns out by 20 days we mean sit down for this 20 days. And by a response, we mean a response, not a letter on the 20th working day saying that at some unstated day, someone will get back to you. And that's what they were getting away with for years, and the courts let it go. Now, this Crew decision was very helpful, in which they said, no, in fact, you need a substantive, you need essentially tell them the university responsive documents and the expected production schedule. That's very helpful because that was clearly the law's intent. Now, with that said, generally the courts will say, well, the agencies are, they're very busy, you file a lot of requests, they're probably working as hard as they can, they claim they're being diligent and so on. However, if a judge has particular experience, Royce Lamberth, for example, recently with Landmark Legal, he issued an opinion in the last few months in which he said it appears, and they used one of our exemplars from the Richard Windsor case, showing that the deputy administrator was using his private account for work, bob@purchaseppi.com. With that exemplar, Judge Lamberth said, it seems that there are people at the agency using private email accounts and not searching those accounts in response to FOI requests. And so I question this declaration by the EPA official. We're going to go back and we're going to head toward discovery here, which is allowed under the local rule, but rare. He had this experience with Landmark, with EPA, with FOIA, in 2001 through 2003, with a case I discuss in the book, which actually led to me learning about Richard Windsor, the false identity. The Friday before the Bush inauguration in 2001, Carol Browner came into her office at EPA and asked or ordered her hard drive reformatted. Somebody testified later she didn't speak in those terms. Thursday night, DOJ, Judge Lamberth, had issued a preservation order saying we're going to see your emails with these green groups about midnight regulations, and Friday morning she came in and said, reformat my hard drive, and DOJ said, well, we forgot to tell our client. And that didn't go over well with Judge Lamberth. It led to a massive effort to rip out hard drives from thousands of computers. They finally found hers. The FBI scrutinized it, said, yes, it's been reformatted. We can't read it. And the subsequent administrator was held in contempt. Judge Lamberth remembered all of this. And so when he got this case, he dealt with them the way all of us wish the courts would deal with these agencies that we find doing these things. I say regrettably, they don't. The agency gets just as much benefit of the doubt here as they do in a typical APA rulemaking case.
We've got two questions pending. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Yes, hi. This is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. Chris, two questions on your Virginia Supreme Court case. Number one, if the court rules in your favor, will these ClimateGate emails be released, or does the case go back down for further proceedings? And two, is the case strictly a matter of state law, or would there be grounds for Supreme Court review for the disappointed party?
I expect that this would then go back down to the trial court or for further deliberation. I don't think there are several issues before the court, and one of them involves materially prevailing, one of them involves proprietary information, and it's going to get down to then what is proprietary information, and there are various subcategories of emails, unsolicited emails sent to Michael Mann, and yet they're being held as proprietary information. And then there are others claiming that this is research related to a published paper, so, or an unpublished paper. So this will actually, I'm sure, just lead to much more deliberation. And I don't think there is any other no other action anticipated, no federal cause of action. Is that what you asked there, Leo?
Yeah, if there was any grounds for Supreme Court review, U.S. Supreme Court review.
No, I'm not aware of any.
All right, thank you.
We've got one caller question pending. If you would like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Andy Klein, and I appreciate all the information you're relaying here. A lot of us out here in the practice world deal with the FOIA issues on a much more mundane level. In my case, I deal a lot with the FCC, and it's somewhat ironic that the Federal Communications Commission has been in the position of not complying with communication obligations as they relate to FOIA disclosure. So I've had some experience with them where they've simply found different ways to resist the disclosure of information that they should be disclosing, things like internal emails, correspondence with outside parties under different grounds. And I guess the question I would have is, on a practical level, when making a FOIA request, you know, A, kind of how best do you go about limiting the agency's ability to squirm out of their request, for lack of a better word, and two, you know, in terms of framing the request, is it generally advisable to be more general in the overall approach, or to be general and specific, or specific and then general, because you want to make sure obviously you're getting everything that's related, but you don't want the agency to then turn around and give you all the nonsense, you know, and then say, well, now we've spent all the money that you've said you're willing to pay in terms of the fees. So I'm right. Looking for any practical guidance you'd be able to provide on those aspects.
The latter first. I proceed, it's ad hoc, because sometimes you know what you're looking for, and you always are pursuing a known unknown. And it typically leads to learning about unknown unknowns. And so I would view it as a first putt. I would view it just putt to get the ball near where you can sink it. I would view it as the first of several, and not try to make it comprehensive. You don't want to give them any grounds to do what they're predisposed to do, which is say this is overly broad and it'll cost you a fortune. You want to target it in your time parameters, in your make the first one as targeted as you can, and know that you can follow up, even though, of course, they are going to delay, and so each subsequent measure is going to be delayed by at least 60 days. But with that said, now we just have to begin by saying, I'm speaking about emails, whether or not they're sent from your official account, but including any other account that was used at any time for work-related correspondence, sending or receiving. And again, it's because all of these appointees are continuing to correspond with their previous universe of colleagues on their previous point of contact, their old account. I'm finding it all of the time. And so ask for the non-official email account as well, and you're referring to text messaging. That is provided as an alternative to email. It is to be managed as email records are to be managed, and they, at least at EPA, are knowingly being destroyed. And that is why I was told by someone who won't go on the record that is why someone was being much more candid on her text messaging, to the point she was hailed into the general counsel's office and told, stop texting. It's going to blow up in the agency's face, in all of our faces. Because she knew those weren't being maintained. But you have to ask for them anyway, because the response will imply, if they don't state, that they've searched them, and that may give you further recourse later. But I would try to be as targeted as you can in the first one, simply because their first, including, as we know from emails we found among themselves, their first line of defense is to say it's overly broad, because each one buys them at least a month each time they pull that, and that it'll cost more than whatever it is you agreed to pay. But make sure you're expanding this to include not just their official email account and not just email.
We've got about 10 minutes left. We have no questions pending. If you have a question, Let's make this the last call for questions. Actually, we do have another question now, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Tuan Samahan from Villanova Law School. I wonder to what extent the court's attitude toward FOIA requests might be a function of the universal venue provision that allows many suits to be brought in D.C., and that there's a sense when you're searching through a haystack for that needle that the needle might not be worth the search. Is there any empirical suggestion that one has a greater likelihood of prevailing on FOIA requests outside of D.C.?
I'll be honest with you. I don't have any experience with it outside of D.C. except for some state laws. And the one time we considered it, it was going to – the alternative was in Colorado, and we had outside counsel helping us on this, and they said it's just the precedent in D.C. that is just – so much more favorable. Now, that was just, that involved the Smithsonian Institution and definition of an agency, I think, and some one other item, and that was my only experience with it. They're certainly much more used to dealing with it in the D.C. circuit, and obviously that's where an awful lot of the precedent comes from, but some of them, come to think of it, a lot of the on-point precedent we are finding as we're building out what this law means in an age that the law wasn't drafted really contemplating. That was all sorts of other communications forms that are making – when you used to walk down the hall to have a conversation, you don't anymore. You send an email. But as somebody said, the best way to not create a record is not create a record. But they're doing it, and instead of walking down the hall to have the conversation, they're moving it over to Gmail. Which is that's the wrong response. But with it, as we try to get the law to wrap around reality now, the applicable cases we are finding are not from D.C., really. We're finding developments out in Michigan, trying to remember where else. So it may be. I don't have any empirical evidence other than to say that the cases we're finding, and they're all district court level, that are seeming to be more on point are coming from outside of D.C.
So my experience was in just talking anecdotally to people is that very often at the D.C. circuit level, many of the FOIA matters are handled by staff attorneys who are sort of FOIA staff attorney specialists. They're not even sort of elbow law clerks for the judges. And from their perspective, they're just engaging in docket management and are sort of disposed to not grant the FOIA request. And so I wonder to what extent that might represent an opportunity to file elsewhere to the extent venue may also lie elsewhere and give judges who aren't going to be so knee-jerk inclined to dismiss and perhaps also not be so pro-executive as perhaps some of the judges in the D.C. Circuit may be.
I can think of just personal experience data points that just lead me to believe that may be the case. And again, this was aberrant, but it happened. I just only after we got a new judge and filing twice notices of supplemental authority to get some attention after 2 years, or it'll be 2 years next week, fully briefed motion for summary judgment, did we get a response. There was not that much interest in attending to the case. I suppose it's viewed, because there are so many more here, that it may be viewed with a lower priority. Fortunately, again, that was aberrant, but there are reasons to believe that may be the case and that the sympathy for the agency is much greater in D.C.
Thank you.
Looks like we have time for a final question. Let's go to our final caller.
Yeah, this is Brad Brown. I mean, and I'm with MITRE, but I also served as a chief counsel in an agency, and I agree with the last comment. I think in a large case, you know, FOIA is not the highest priority within an agency. It's also usually dispersed, so there's no typically no centralized location for FOIA, it's in each agency. And so, you know, these agencies are overwhelmed with FOIA requests. These you know, lower-level law clerks, if you will, have to then go around and around the agency and find out who knows anything about the request. You know, it's not an easy process for the agencies either, and they're not really well set up to handle the volume of what they get.
Chris Horner, you want to respond there?
Well, I recall, I think it was the Tellico Dam case where the court made it clear that if costs were an issue, Congress would have said so, and they didn't. So stop the dam. In this case, while the courts have said if you can establish that the circumstances require, you can go in the open American case, you can take as long as you claim you need until it appears to the court abusive, but they are to comply. And the Crewe opinion, again, was game-changing in that they said, you're going to have to do what you can try to do. Go to Congress, do what you can. But the law is what it is, and you've had 47 years to figure out, and people getting more interested in transparency, and now the president inviting the public to find out what their government is up to, find a way to comply with the law. So that was a good sign. This is a burden to them, but it is a burden to them. Mm-hmm. It's a requirement. It's an obligation.
Well, I mean, I think some of the general counsel's offices have to get serious about, you know, how they're going to handle it and how it's going to be structured and to really budget for the volume. And, you know, and be able to have a way to reach out across the agency, you know, to talk with the appropriate policy people who are engaged with whatever the request is about to respond.
Yeah. One thing I point out in the book is somebody at one of the agencies who was a career said that what was unique is that the general counsel had required a weekly meeting from the FOIA staff to tell them about all requests that came in and brief them on all that they wanted to go out. And now you could read this either way. And remember, not everybody, of course, is trying to stiff you, as I think you're also intimating. But the motivation here, according to the person speaking to me, seemed to be we're very politically attuned to the threats of what transparency could mean to us. And so we're going to keep a pretty tight grip on what comes in and what goes out, but we're going to be aware immediately about what comes in. You could view that, twist your prism the other way, and say, okay, now they're trying to get their hands around this. In this particular case, the individual speaking to me said that it was more they were trying to get their hands around the political threat posed by it. But yes, greater general counsel attention and involvement would be helpful, unless it was, as this person was saying, was likely the case, toward mitigating threats that come in.
Well, I think we've exhausted the questions for the audience. Let me give first Clark Neely, if you want to express a final thought, and then Chris Horner before we wrap up here.
Well, sure. Thanks, Dean. I really just wanted to reiterate how much I enjoyed reading the book and to sort of emphasize something that Chris writes at the end of the book, where he says that people have an idea about, you know, how things should be different or something the government is up to that it's not. He says it's incumbent upon you when an idea strikes to not presume that someone's got it covered and to go out and get the information yourself. And I couldn't agree with that more, and I hope people will do that.
Final thought, Chris Horner.
Yeah, first, thanks for this. And second, following up on what Clark said, I wish every group, every C3, had a FOIA practice. And I wish that more firms, Gibson Dunn has been great to us. They were the first ones to really get us moving on this a few years ago on one of the NASA cases. Reach out and say, you know what, with our pro bono obligation, we're going to represent groups who are trying to hold the president to his vow to be the most transparent administration in history. That would be a very productive use of your firm's pro bono commitment.
Well, today I want to thank both Mr. Chris Horner, the author of the book we've been talking about, Liberal War on Transparency, Confessions of a Freedom of Information Criminal, and Mr. Clark Neely for his participation as well. I want to thank the audience as well, and I encourage our audience to join us for our next Teleform conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing regulation of telecommunications. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.